This is an interview with Roger Mansell for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project by David Arms at the Naval Reserve Center, 315 East Laclede, Youngstown, Ohio, May 7th, 1975, approximately 6:15 p.m. Roger, could you just give me some of your family background and your education in your earlier years?
Okay. I was born and raised in the Niles-Warren area. Born in Warren, but lived most of my life in Niles. Went to grade school at Washington Elementary and then junior high at Washington Junior High. Graduated from Niles McKinley High School in 1948. Stood 10th in my class, I might add. Went on to Miami University at Oxford, Ohio, where I majored in business administration. Marketing and merchandising was a major field, as was naval science, because I enrolled in the contract program of the NROTC there. I received my commission upon graduation in 1952, was handed orders for 2 years of active duty, and reported to San Francisco for duty aboard MSTS transports in the Pacific. My first ship was the USS General Butner, a Navy man transport. Am I getting off the subject now?
No, go right ahead. Okay. Tell me all about this.
My first ship was the USS General Butner, which was a Navy man transport. We hauled 1,500 troops and 350 cabin passengers. My first assignment was a junior deck officer in the 1st Division. I was then transferred into the Transportation Department and became the T Division officer. As T Division officer, I had 50 stewards mates who were charged with the responsibility for maintaining the cabin passenger area and serving meals in the cabin passenger dining room. It was also my job to load and unload the embarked troops and work with the troop staff, conduct daily inspections of troop spaces, and I served in that capacity for a total of a year aboard the USS General Butner. From there I went to the USNS General Heintzelman, a civilian manned MSTS transport. I was the division officer, and as such loaded and unloaded troops. It was what we call an austere trooper and did not carry women and children as cabin passengers such as the General Butner did. I was aboard the General Heintzelman for 6 months and was then subsequently ordered to the USNS Private Jose Valdez, which was a civilian manned, very small, motor-driven transport, which would carry 20 cabin passengers, including women and children, and 100 troops. And we made a milk run to St. John's, Newfoundland, Harmon Air Force Base, and the Argentia Naval Station there on a monthly basis. I served for 6 months on that ship as commanding officer of the military department, doing much the same work I'd done on the other two ships. I was released from active duty in June of 54. Upon return home, I entered the fire and casualty and life insurance business in an agency which had been started by my father in 1945, and I succeeded to the ownership of that agency upon his death in 1963.
You mentioned that you were aboard all these different ships for just a short period of time. Was that common in the USNS business at that time, just to order you aboard for...
Right. They would shuffle junior officers, especially, around quite indiscriminately and as the need required. MSTS did its own... personnel assignment. Once an officer was ordered in, then they took care of interdepartmental assignments.
Is there any special reason why they such short tours on these ships? Or?
Not to my knowledge.
It just worked out that way?
Personnel turnover.
So you came back to Ohio and you settled down. You went in the insurance business. When did you join the reserve program?
I remember going to the Reserve Center almost immediately after returning home, within the next 30 days. I believe I had been told about the Naval Reserve during my out-processing at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And went to Warren, interviewed then Lieutenant James Ronion, who was commanding officer of the Naval Reserve Division, and decided to sign on as a, what they called then, a platoon officer. I was Lieutenant J.G. at the time.
Were you required to report in? Was this part of your obligation, or was this
no,
on your own free will?
No, this was strictly voluntary. And I really can't say what my prime motivation was, although I remember at the time it just seemed like a good deal, a good thing to do. In starting in the insurance business, I was starting on a drawing account for one thing, and the money was attractive.
Do you remember what you used to get paid in those days?
Oh, it wasn't a whole lot. I think it was more like, I think a quarterly check used to run about $80. That would have been 13 drills. So it was $5 or $6 a drill, something like that, as a Lieutenant J.G.
Can you remember what you used to do with this money?
I used to improve my standard of living at the time, because I was using up my savings and on a drawing account. A drawing account has to be paid back, so I was trying to keep it to a minimum, and I used it to live on.
Were you married at the time?
I was married and had a boy.
I see. Were you married when you were in the service? Is that it?
Yes. Matter of fact, I married 5 days after I graduated, and my wife went with me when I reported into San Francisco. But after transferring ships, she went back home and lived at home for the balance of my two-year tour.
Now, when you went on this active, it was during the Korea basic idea, just trying to relate to the Vietnam era. Can you remember any of the hesitancy for people going on active duty at the time, or the general attitude of your classmates towards going on active duty?
The Korean War started in 1950. I was about halfway through college at the time. It became evident within the first year that the war was underway that we would probably be ordered to active duty upon receiving our commissions at graduation. By the time we were seniors, that was a foregone conclusion. I do recall that there were not the student demonstrations against the war that we experienced in the Vietnam era, that the people I associated with at college were very much interested, as a matter of fact, in accepting their orders and going on active duty and doing their bit. And it did not cause panic in the minds of these young men. As a matter of fact, I think most of them really look forward to it rather eagerly.
What do you contribute this to? Why would someone look forward to going?
Well, by the time I graduated, of course, the war had been underway for 2 years. Many young men had been drafted. And I think it was a sense of sitting on the sidelines for 2 years while other people were fighting the war and getting killed and getting wounded, and it was just an attitude that, by golly, that's where the action was, that's where we ought to be. At least I recall this as being more or less my attitude. Ironically enough, I never saw a shot fired in anger. I was ordered to a ship in San Francisco. It was home ported there, but almost immediately after I reported aboard, the home port was changed to New York. And I went around through the canal, and that was it as far as the chance of coming anywhere near a war zone. A lot of my fellow students did, of course, see action in Korea.
How did you feel about this? Were you upset, or?
I don't recall being upset, no. I don't recall being relieved either. I just recall it as being a the type of thing that happens in the management of the military. They needed the ship at the Atlantic instead of the Pacific. Also, the war, I believe, was winding down at that time, and it ended in 1953, shortly before I got out. I got out of service in 54.
When you were released, you say you were released from New York. Do you remember any of your out processing? Was it done in a building at one time, or was this a gradual thing?
I was released from the ship 10 days before I was to be released from active duty. I believe I got most of my information on a piecemeal basis over a 10-day period. I recall getting information on insurance, for example, and one of the first things I did was to elect to keep my GI insurance. And I found out subsequently that I must have been one of the very few people that realized what good advice he was getting, because so many of the Vietnam era people didn't keep their GI insurance.
You mentioned Vietnam era, you mean
Korean era, yeah.
So you came back and you joined the reserve program. Mm-hmm. Could you just give me an idea of what your first impressions upon joining the reserve program were?
Don't remember back that far, really.
What were some of the early meetings like? Maybe you got to bring it around. When you first went to meetings, do you recall anything that happened there? Could you describe to me what actually took place at a meeting?
Well, we started off with the first muster on a drill deck. Each platoon officer, back in those days, we were called variously rating group supervisors, platoon officers, group supervisory officers, and I can't remember which one really it started out with. I think it was platoon officer, but we had a group of people we were responsible for. As a rating group supervisor, I was in charge of the engineering rates. I had machinery repairmen and a couple of other engineering rates. Machinery repairmen were my biggest group. We used to then, after first muster, go into the machine shop and or a classroom, depending on the schedule for the night, and do practical work on the machines or have a lecture. My job was to supervise the training, assign instructors, assign replacements if an instructor was absent, make sure the training schedule was adhered to, make sure that attendance on the part of the people in my group was monitored. And things stayed like that pretty much for 15 years.
Could you, I understand that you were signed up in Warren, Ohio, under a Lieutenant Ronian.
Right.
Could you just kind of explain, I understand also that the training center is closed now, what that center was like facilities-wise? Could you just give us an idea?
All right. This training center had a one-story frame head house, which consisted mainly of the administrative offices. It was then the head house was joined to three side-by-side Quonset huts. The center Quonset hut was an open affair, which was used as a drill hall, and we held our musters there. Runs in my mind there was a gun mount and perhaps a stable element computer, a loading machine, I think about a 5-inch loading machine on the drill deck. And later we marked out the outline of a ship. There was a bridge in the drill deck, and we outlined the outline of the ship such as it represented then the deck area. And we used to simulate docking drills, firing the gun, general quarters. The two head house, the two Quonset huts, one on either side of the center one, were the classroom areas and shops.
Were these two floors or one?
One floor.
Where was this located at Warren?
Located on Elm Road, right near Harding High School, in front of the then Trumbull County Fairgrounds.
You mentioned also that you did docking drills and simulated fire the gun. Could you just give a basic explanation of how something like this might be done from that bridge?
Or? Well, we'd make up a watch quarter station bill for all hands in the division. Our division ran variously from 80 people to 135 or 40. Every man would have a battle station, and when general quarters would sound, like the gun crew would mount the engineers would go to the mock-up engine room, the repair party would go to the repair locker, the officers on the bridge would arrive there, and would simulate being underway, fighting the ship, fighting fires, simulate hits, would do a battle problem, have simulated injuries. Corpsmen would take the injured people to sick bay and treat them. Tried to give it as much realism as possible as you can on a stationary platform. We had some very skilled craftsmen who made up things like cleats and bollards, and these were portable, and they would be arranged on the simulated dock, which was also outlined on the drill floor, as well as the ship outline. We'd actually have line handling drills for the seamen. For a while, we were in the business of training sailors, like basic training, and we used to run them through those line handling drills out there, and then teach them how to splice and teach them knots and things of that nature. But as far as the general quarters drills were concerned, we tried to keep them as much as like a shipboard drill as possible.
Could you just give me an idea of the basic administrative organization of the training center? How many units were assigned to this? When did you drill?
There was one unit, a medium surface division. It was headed at that time by a lieutenant. The executive officer was a lieutenant. There were four or five other officers. When I joined, I was the youngest one there. The training center commanding officer was a lieutenant. He had five or six, maybe seven, enlisted men who were station keepers. Drill night was Thursday night in the early years. Stayed that way for a long, long time. Then was changed to Monday night toward the latter part of the history of the Warren Reserve Training Center. The only other use of the building was by civic groups who met there, and for a while there was a Sea Explorer scout troop that met there. The Coast Guard Auxiliary regularly met there. The Civil Air Patrol unit met there, but only the one Naval Reserve unit.
Can you recall any of the active duty people that were there, or how often were they there? Did they rotate around, or?
You want them by name?
If you can remember, surely, yes.
Well, I can remember Lieutenant Ostovich. Not Ostovich. Wow. Yeah, by golly, Lieutenant Ostovich, I understand he's now captain. There was Lieutenant Commander Price, Lieutenant Commander Yankovich, who subsequently retired and moved back to Warren and settled there. We had Lieutenant Werner Steffen, who was in charge at the time the training center closed and subsequently became commanding officer of the Naval Reserve Training Center in Youngstown. Those are the only ones I can remember by name. I remember one station keeper yeoman by the name of Guy Chamberlain, who finished up his obligated service, took his discharge, stayed in Warren, went to work as a public relations man with the American Welding Company, did such a fine job, it came to the attention of an advertising man who lured him away from American Welding and formed an advertising agency, and now they're president and vice president of the Ted Burton Associates Advertising Agency, and are the head agency that handles the Kenley Players account. There were other regular Navy station keepers whose names I remember. One was a Chief Walter Burton. He became a customer of mine. Bob Fritz. Number of others.
When you came into the center, or joined the reserves up there in Warren, what kind of activities? Did you become involved in any activities in the center, outside the center, involved with the center that you could tell us about?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we used to have a little social hour at the Rancho Villa following drill, and I remember one storekeeper first class by the name of Earlston very well, because he threw my wife under a table one night when they were dancing at this Rancho Villa. That got to be quite a tradition. A number of the wives would come deliver their husbands to drill, then come pick them up, and we'd go out and have a few drinks afterwards for an hour or so. One of the things I became personally involved in and was involved in for many years was the drill team. We would have a drill team of 21 or more volunteers. Some of the members of the drill team are still active in the Naval Reserve now. I remember Chief Bob Cross was very active. And we used to go to all the parades and show the blue suit to the people on Memorial Day, Labor Day. We used to go to homecomings, and it runs in my mind we used to maybe do 10, 12 of those in a spring, summer, and fall season. It's a lot of fun and an extra activity which men enjoyed doing at the time.
For all these outside activities, did they receive drill pay? Did anybody receive drill pay or anything? Or?
We only got drill pay for the Memorial Day parade. It became sort of like a tradition. The city of Warren had a Memorial Day parade, and we'd turn out the division in force for that. All the other was extracurricular. There were a couple of places where we used to go traditionally every year, because they'd donate $25 or $30 to us, and we'd use that to buy equipment.
What kind of equipment could you buy with $25 or $30?
White web belts, white helmet liners, paint to paint them with, leggings.
The government has always been famous for its control of the funds. Can you recall if funds were hard to get to support the reserve unit in Warren? Or?
Seems like off and on always. I remember as a rating group supervisor for the machinery repair people, we sat down and very carefully made out a shopping list of what would be needed to turn that machine shop into a real first-class training facility. For example, it didn't have a milling machine or a turret lathe. So we made out this shopping list. I had a first-class machine repairman by the name of Bob Elwell, who was just real sharp. We wrote the thing all up. We didn't hear anything. We wrote a follow-up. We didn't hear anything. We wrote another follow-up. The district representative came and said, if you need anything, just holler and we'll try to get it for you. So we told him we'd written an original order and two follow-ups and asked him to look into it. We finally got one broken horizontal lathe out of the whole list. We eventually, that group of people eventually made an engraving machine so that we'd have that to train on.
Is this the type of project you became involved in as a unit or something? Is there any other kind of a project that the unit did overall? Getting boats together, going on boat rides, or
used to have one of the chiefs had a restaurant downtown, and we used to have an annual affair in his party room. We used to have a picnic every once in a while. Not too many of those. I recall the parties. We had things like a Monte Carlo party at one time, where we had the gambling wheels and things, and this was done at this chief's restaurant because they always used to give us a deal. We used to have the ordinary ceremonies like change of command ceremonies, award ceremonies that you usually have in connection with a military organization. As far as the civic action type projects, the drill team is what I remember most vividly, and the sponsorship of the Sea Scout unit. Several of our people were involved with that as leaders.
Now, on your training in the unit, did you ever do any field trips or anything like that with your unit on a training basis?
Yeah, we used to take the men out at the police firing range and fire familiarization with M1s, 45 caliber automatics, and we had some 22 rifles and target pistols. The men used to enjoy doing that. We try to do that once a quarter, both for weapons familiarization and morale. We also used to, during the time I was commanding officer of the service division there, which was a 3-year tenure, I believe we did 5 or 6 weekends on the PCE that was up in Cleveland. During that time, we got underway, I think we got underway and were underway for 4 of the weekends, visiting places like Put-In Bay, Port Stanley in Canada. During the time I was in the lower ranks, I can remember going up to the ship on a number of occasions where, because of mechanical difficulties, it couldn't get underway. This made us very discouraged, and it was found that when the ship did not get underway, the men weren't interested in going. And so the thing would sort of run hot and cold. And I feel I was real lucky because the first trip that I arranged after becoming CO, the ship got underway. We had a real good training weekend. We had liberty in a foreign port, and I had no trouble crewing up for working. I shot at 2 weekends per summer for the operating season. I would take a special trip to Cleveland ahead of these things in the spring to schedule our weekends and work with the ship's people on training schedules and get the organizational details taken care of so that we could just climb aboard our transportation. And we used to send an advance party up on Friday night, draw bedding, and have everything ready and just the group go upset.
Could you be a little bit more explicit on what you did during your trips to the ship? What kind of training did you do? Where did you go specifically? What did your men fit in with the crew, or did they stand separately, or what?
No, the men fit in with the crew. They became watchstanders. When the crew would recognize a particularly well-qualified member of the division, he would be on a regular watch bill, stand on watches alone. And I remember we had some very good engine men, and they were standing throttle watches on the engine, because the ship's company was a skeleton crew, and it was necessary that this happen, because when the men weren't particularly well qualified, why, the ship's crew would have to stand 6 and 8 hour watches to supervise the reservists. I feel we had a pretty well qualified bunch, because as I say, we had several engine men that would stand throttle watches. We had a couple of quartermasters that didn't need any help on the bridge, We had some qualified deck officers that didn't need any help staying on watches. And most of all, the attitude of the ship's crew seemed to be such that they were happy to see us come aboard.
Have you found this true throughout your relationship with the Naval Reserve? Have you been readily accepted by the regular active duty forces?
There have been a couple of cases where I felt that we weren't. As a matter of fact, ironically enough, there were a couple of cases on reserve destroyers, which should have been really positively inclined towards the Naval Reserve. And I didn't feel that they had a good sense of mission, and I didn't feel that they had the right mental attitude as far as accepting reservists into the crew and doing the training they were supposed to do. In most of my active duty experiences, the regular Navy people have been more than courteous. They've been more than willing to take our suggestions, use our talents. The one I just came back from was an outstanding example of this. I was attached to FIB Group 2, and the attitude of that group was that they couldn't run the exercise unless they got reserve augmentation. And this was their ordinary course of doing business. Whenever they had an exercise, they put in for reserve augmentation.
Do you think that the reserves have changed in their relationship to the regular Navy in the last years or so?
No, and that sort of troubles me too. Because overall I feel that the regular Navy sort of tolerates the existence of the Naval Reserve rather than welcomes it. And as I say, that is from a person that's really had some good experiences as far as cooperation from active duty people. And then again, sometimes the cooperation you get is directly proportional to the cooperation you give. I know some reservists would go aboard ship and immediately start complaining. They didn't pick the laundry up soon enough, the underwear got lost, the ship's door was never open, they couldn't get a haircut, water hours, no liberty, that kind of thing. Naturally, this turns the active duty people off. But I really have felt over the years that the regular Navy did not treat its Naval Reserve as a tool to be used. And that is until this particular experience with FIB Group 2. I think this is just an outstanding example of what a Naval Reserve can be to a regular Navy.
Could you explain a little bit more what you did then? I mean, it impressed you this much, you must have really accomplished...
Well, it wasn't that I accomplished so much. They really didn't need me. They needed lieutenants, lieutenant commanders, commanders as watchstanders. They needed them as tactical communicators. They needed them as staff watch officers on the flag bridge, as staff watch officers in the flag command space. They needed the enlisted people to round out the ranks of the NTDS operators and communications people, radiomen. They just had everybody working. And I think they were sort of lucky because we had a group of 28 people. That's combined with the Tactical Air Control Group. We had 6 and we had 22. And we had a good bunch of people, and they went right to work and they did the job, and they got good marks at the end of the thing. And as I say, the attitude of the staff was such that they really needed these people to carry the job off because they were so short-handed themselves.
Well, we're speaking of your active duty experiences, in your two-week training programs, is there any other active duty periods in that two-week type attitude that really stand out in your mind for one reason or another, that you did something extra exciting or other than this immediate past one, or was amusing or anything to that fact? Do you get a big kick out of going on these 2 weeks, or how does that affect you?
Well, my very first active duty for training was on an LSD. And we visited Bermuda as a Liberty Corps. And I suppose that in itself sold me on the whole idea of continuing. During this period of time, I had 7 destroyer cruises. One destroyer cruise stands out particularly vividly because I was on one of first two destroyers to visit the port of Santo Domingo after the assassination of the dictator Trujillo. And we were very welcome there and were able to see the city. And that occurred in October, and by April the Marines were landing, taking out American nationals because the political situation had deteriorated so badly. That particular cruise also stands out from the standpoint of the fact that the skipper of the ship was just an outstanding, had a good positive attitude towards reservists and training them, and allowed me and the other junior officers to do more ship handling than I'd ever done before. I had one school that was a sort of an outstanding thing. It was an officer of the deck underway school in Philadelphia. And we spent the whole weekend and 2 other half days aboard a wooden-hulled minesweeper in the river, conning it up and down the river, learning ship handling. As a matter of fact, so many officers and no enlisted people, we were handling lines for each other. And it was fun and it was educational because we felt we were really getting our hands on the hardware and learning to do the job. Although it was really a 12-day grind because we used our weekend, our intermediate weekend, for the training on the river.
So would you say your 2-week stints have been most educational or fun?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, well, I remember one was sort of a waste. Got aboard a destroyer that was in an upkeep period. The first week was fine. I found a couple of short schools on a base at Newport that I could go to, but the second week was dead.
I'm not asking you to put yourself in a precarious position of any kind, but what do you do in your off time when you're on these cruises? In your spare time, your liberty, per se.
My liberty?
Right. What do you find interesting to do on these?
Well, when I go on liberty. sightsee, mainly. I take 35mm color slides, and I got a bundle of them from these cruises, and I enjoy that. And that's one of the reasons I particularly enjoyed Santo Domingo, because it was a beautiful place, and I got a lot of good pictures. And because of its turbulent recent history at the time, made it more interesting. So the graffiti on the walls and the mutilated statue of the previous dictator, or of Trujillo, and things of that nature. At sea, I do a lot of reading that I don't get time for at home.
You mentioned when you talked about your 2 weeks, your first one, you decided on continuing. Why do you? Can you really say, why do you continue at the present time in the reserve?
There's 3 reasons. One, it's a good hobby, and I've enjoyed it, and it's one which produces a little bit of income, whereas other hobbies wouldn't. The other thing is I like to feel I'm patriotic enough to want to continue in it, and I'm doing something for my country. I think if I couldn't feel that way, even the money wouldn't be worth it. In other words, I think it's important enough to the welfare of the country that there be a naval reserve and that I be in it to keep me going.
Going on the, or just getting back to the history a little bit, what do you belong to any organizations other than the Naval Reserve, which are ever related to the Navy in any way, or
belong to the Navy League, the Reserve Officers Association, and the Naval Reserve Association?
Do you participate in any of the functions thereof? Or?
I really haven't been active within the last year and a half, 2 year time period. But at various times I was held office. I was vice president and secretary of the Navy League. I'm past president of the Trumbull County Reserve Officers Association. I haven't held office in the Naval Reserve Association because it's been sort of inactive in the area.
What, can you give me any idea of some of the projects that they've maybe done that you're aware of to help the Navy in any way in the Mahoning Trumbull County area?
Yeah, the Navy League sponsors a Sea Cadet unit, which has its ups and its downs, as any youth type program has. And I think it's, you could almost relate it to the success of its leaders and the consistency of its leadership. Finding leaders for a youth group of that nature is pretty tough sometimes. The Reserve Officers Association is very active in the Memorial Day observance in Warren and participates very heavily in that, and also gives out medals to the outstanding ROTC graduates at the various colleges around the area, as well as keeping its members up to date by issuing a very good monthly magazine called The Officer. As a matter of fact, I consider the membership in the three organizations to be sort of important because combining their publications together gives me a good source of all-around information, keeps me current on what's going on.
Are you interested in that part of the Navy or the Naval Reserve or anything in publications, or you strictly use them as a benefit to yourself?
Strictly use them to gain knowledge. I've thought trying to write for publication in them. I haven't just taken the time to do that, though.
Going back to the Warren Reserve Center, since it's no longer active, could you give me some ideas about its closing and then the move from there to the Youngstown Reserve Center?
Sure. We'd start hearing rumors in advance and during a budget pinch. And it really became sort of evident that a one-unit reserve center was not cost-efficient. But I do recall having a farewell dinner for one of the Youngstown Reserve Training Center COs. Had a representative from the 4th Naval District in, and we decided to check out, there was a contingent office from Warren, we decided to check out the rumor, and by golly, he looked us right in the eye and said, no, I said, the Warren Training Center will be with us for another 5 years at least. Well, within a year, we were going to be closed. As I mentioned before, Lieutenant Werner Steffen was Training Center CO. He immediately set about to package up all the equipment, tools, and organize the transfer of people to the Youngstown Reserve Center. I had been a commanding officer of the unit about that time for about 2 years. I remember we moved the people here to Youngstown about a month and a half before the final closing of the training center. After we were gone, the station keepers then spent the rest of the time stripping all evidences of Navy out and crating them up and shipping them back. The building was put up for sale, and I believe the United Steelworkers of America paid a sum of $18,000 for the building, and which was on land which was leased from the City of Warren or the Warren School Board. And as far as I know, that arrangement still exists. They own the building and the school board of the city owns the land. I think they got a real bargain when they bought that building for $18,000 because it was in fairly good shape at the time.
Then everybody that was attached there drilled in Youngstown.
Right.
And you came down as CO?
Yeah, I was the CO for then my final year here. We drilled on a different night than the other medium surface division, which was attached to the Warren Training Center. About that same time, Youngstown had had two medium training centers, and about that same time, I believe they were merged into one.
I see. Let me just flip tapes over here.
I'll do it back when you're having fun.
That's it. You were discussing, just as you came down from the Warren Reserve Center, what was the number of that unit in Warren? Do you remember?
The number of people I recall about that time was between 60 and 80.
In the unit?
Yeah.
How many officers?
Four or five.
And was there any problem when you moved down here? Did people drop out of the unit because of...
Yeah, we lost a few people. Some of the people that we lost weren't any great loss because they weren't good attenders or weren't contributing. The bulk of the hardcore stayed. Didn't really make too much difference to them how far they had to drive because they wanted to stay. We, as far as problems were concerned, I think the biggest problem was to meld in with the organization that was here. We were treated somewhat as outsiders for as long as 2 years, that Warren bunch. Even though, and this persisted even after men started to transfer back and forth between the two units. The combined Youngstown unit then went to weekend drills, so that there would be a choice between a Tuesday night or weekly drill and a 1 weekend a month arrangement. Well, some of the people from Youngstown decided they wanted weekly drills. Some of the people from Warren decided a weekend would be better. We switched and swapped them, and still the Tuesday night unit was referred to as the Warren unit, and many of our people believed they were being given short shrift on service from the station keepers. That there was a hard core from Warren, and I remember one group in particular. The chief petty officers were organized into a social club they called the Chiefs Club, and they sort of maintained their identity even to this very day, I believe, starting from the hard core that came from Warren.
I see. You mentioned that the Warren unit drilled, or the unit that came down from Warren originally, stayed on the Tuesday night. The Youngstown went to... How was this controlled as a group, as all Naval Reservists? Were they directly reported? Who did they report to?
All right, there was a group commander who used to be known as a battalion commander, and he had a staff of variously from 3 to 6 or 8 people. And he was charged with the administration of the reserve units under his command. This included not only the two medium surface divisions, but it also included the MSTS division, the CBs, and I believe that was all the units. He would provide guidance and coordination and inspection services to the organizations under his command.
Now, who was he responsible to?
He was then responsible to directly to the district, equal to and parallel with the training center commanding officer.
Could you recall the names of some of these individuals?
I can't put them in any particular order. There was Captain Russell Heltzel. There was Jim Ronion, who by that time had become been promoted to the rank of commander. There was Neil Smith, Tom Petzinger, who is now Captain Tom Petzinger. Neil Smith, by the way, is captain too. He made his captaincy after he left the area. There were several others who...
Yeah, I understand that the
the group command is now defunct.
I was the last group commander.
How did you come to this position?
Come to the position of group commander?
Commander, right.
The policy of the Naval District was that the people in commanding officers' positions or group commanders' positions were allowed a total of 3 years service. They were given a 1 year appointment subject to renewal for two or more years. The position became open because of someone reaching the end of his 3 year tour, and I applied for the job and was appointed group commander almost immediately, well, within 4 months. The restructuring of the Naval Reserve was announced. One of the first drawdowns was the abolishment of many of the smaller group commands, and we were given the word that we would be one of the first to be abolished. So I served out the 1 year as group command and then deactivated the staff.
Do you recall anything about the deactivation that might be important?
No, really, we sort of faded away. The year was not particularly noteworthy because of we didn't want to start any particular big projects. We had one going at the behest of Captain Stusnik of the 3rd Naval District. That was the construction of the damage control trainer at the rear, in the rear of the building. And it was felt that keeping that project going and running personnel inspections for the units, checking their training schedules and doing things like that was sufficient rather than to get into any really aggressive programs, because if we had done that, we wouldn't have been able to follow through after the activation of the group command.
Now on your staff, was everybody being paid for their duties, or how, were you paid on a 48 drill basis, or?
Yeah, I was paid on a 48 drill basis. I had a chief of staff who was Commander Kale, who I believe at the time was non-pay. He was not in the right grade to be on the staff. I had Lieutenant Commander Ed Murphy, who was being paid. I had Chief Yeoman Lena Summers, and several other yeomen who did not last very long during that year for one reason or another. I think it was allowed 6 people.
After the this establishment of the deactivation of the group command staff, then what did you go into?
Well, prior to becoming the group commander, I had served as the public affairs officer for the Youngstown Training Center for a period of 5 years. And I was interested in the public affairs business, but I did not want to become the public affairs officer for the training center at Youngstown, mainly because I'd been that for 5 years. So I went out looking for another type of situation and became acquainted with the commanding officer of the Public Affairs Company of Columbus. I signed on with him as a member of his group with the idea that I would be his Northeastern Ohio representative, and he was endeavoring to maintain or build a statewide type of public affairs net officers in a network, which was at various times more or less successful. During that period of time, I undertook a project to educate division commanding officers and or assigned public affairs people in the public affairs business, and we ran a seminar for 1 day here at the Youngstown Training Center, in which we invited radio and TV people, advertising people to participate, give speeches, conduct training sessions, and so on.
How do you feel the reserves, specifically the Naval Reserves, have been accepted in Warren and Youngstown since that was your last experience? Are they accepted into the community?
My experience has been that the Naval Reserve has always enjoyed tremendous public acceptance. Maybe it's pride in the outfit. I feel we have more public acceptance than maybe even the National Guard or the Army Reserve.
What do you attribute this to?
I don't know what to attribute it to. I couldn't put my finger on it.
In your relationships, you've been around, I'm not trying to say...
You've been around a long time.
In your experience through the reserve centers, how do you feel that the reserve centers, both Warren and Youngstown, have been accepted with other centers? Have they fitted in that you can... They fit into the norm, or are they exceptional? Are they accepted by other centers?
You mean in terms of standards of performance, or
right.
in terms of
acceptability?
Acceptability, such as between the Air Force and the Army Reserve.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Most of the time, you just don't have any need to traffic with the other services. Mm-hmm. Okay. I remember. There have been two particular instances where we really have enjoyed outstanding relationships with the other services. As the executive officer of the Surface Division up in Warren, I ran a platoon competition on a quarterly basis, and I dealt with the Air Force Reserve Unit at the Youngstown Air Base for trips, weekend trips, aboard their cargo craft. And this went on for a couple of years, and every quarter when the platoon would win the competition, I'd arrange for a trip. We had groups go to Newport, we had a group go to New Orleans. Once, as a morale factor for the Chiefs Club, we sent them over water to it was Puerto Rico, Air Force trip, and they really enjoyed good rapport with the Air Force. The other occasion was when I was assisting the colonel in charge of the National Security Seminar held at the Youngstown Playhouse. Got tremendous cooperation going between the Army Reserve Center and the Navy Reserve Center in supporting that particular event. We had security problems, we had college student demonstrations, we had administrative jobs to do, we had a lot of paperwork to handle, and the cooperation between the Army and Navy was just outstanding, as well as the Air Force support.
You had just been recently assigned to a unit that was attached to the Naval Reserve Center in Pittsburgh.
Right.
Realizing that's a much larger center than Youngstown and a much larger city, could you run any comparisons or contrasts between the two centers, their operations, manning?
Yeah, you feel more like a little fish in a big pond in a training center like that. They drill every weekend. One weekend is Marine weekend, but the other three weekends are taken up by various Naval Reserves units, some 25 units. As one of the senior commanding officers down there, I felt that I fit in as far as that goes, but because of the size of the operation, you get, of course, the distinct impression that nothing's going to fall through the cracks in the floor if you don't do your job. it's Chief Jones, and. That you're not like the key to the success of the whole operation. That you don't have the constant attention of the station keepers, for example, like you do in a smaller training center where there are fewer groups and less to distract and less to cope with. My experience down there has been real great, though, as far as cooperation with the Reserve Center people, as far as cooperation with the people in the other units. I was the senior man on my weekend, and as such acted like a mini group commander. We didn't have any big problems, we didn't have a lot of people. We got along real well. We did our training program, and I think we got a good thing going. and I hope to pick it up in good shape and drop it down here.
Is there anything that I might have forgotten to ask you that you might be on the tip of your tongue or the front of your mind that you'd like to mention at this time in regards specifically to the history or the chronological events even in Youngstown or Warren? Is there anything we've overlooked in that area?
Yeah, I don't... It would be real important. I used to recall we'd schedule the drill every Thursday night, and the week of the Trumbull County Fair at the fairgrounds was usually an exercise in futility because we turned the drill hall over to the 4-H club, so we couldn't have a formal first muster or anything, final muster. We'd put the men in their classrooms to do their training and their work, and they'd spend the time looking out the windows at the young ladies passing by, and sneaking out the back door to take in the rides and the cotton candy and the exhibits at the fair. And, just nothing happened that night because there was so much confusion. That's one thing that always used to tickle me about the situation there.
Speaking of amusing stories and things of that nature, can you recall, just offhand, I like to kind of end up my interviews with a request. It's a personal rather than request. I like to try to get everybody, well, I've run into quite a few officers that have a favorite sea story, per se, or a story of their adventures or somebody's adventures in the military that they like to relate. Do you have any of these, or... Can you recall one at the time?
I can recall two because I was directly involved in them. We had Lieutenant Commander Price, who was a training center CO. He was a very prim individual. He had been an aide to an admiral, and he was up from the ranks from yeoman, and he was just as prim and proper as he could be. And he never went any place that he didn't have his gloves in his hand, and his suit was immaculate and creased and everything. And he was conducting personnel inspection, and I brought my group to attention very seriously, said, "Sir, I report the machinery repairman ready for inspection," and saluted, and about this time my top button popped off my uniform. And this very prim, and it hit the deck, and you know they're hollow, and they go clunk, clunk, clunk. This very prim, proper individual could hardly keep from breaking up. And it was just, you know, outlandish to watch him there. The other case was when I was executive officer of the division. Want the color ceremony to be very nice at first muster. So we would train the men at hoisting the colors smartly. Now, I would come out to the drill hall. I would stand right underneath the bridge. Right above me was the halyard where the we would fly the colors from. Right under the halyard was a large clock. All right, when the color guard would come forward, they would take the halyard off, hook the colors up, and raise it up. Well, if they stood back far enough, there was no particular problem. But this one night, the young fellow did it, and he was a little close in. And when he yanked that halyard and took those colors up, he hit the clock on the wall, and it came right down and stopped about 6 inches over my head, hung by its cord. And you should have heard him break up on that one. Honest to God, it was funny.
It was lucky for you there was that cord.
Lucky it was plugged in, because it just came down and stopped.
Well, thank you, Roger. I appreciate the information. I'm sure the university will.
Very good. I'm anxious to see it in print.